Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, one of medical science's greatest paradoxes. The cancer cells that killed Henrietta Lacks revolutionized medicine. Medical care her own family couldn't afford.
Her cells, her cancer cells, were really miraculous. They multiplied and stayed alive in the lab, and so were extremely useful for biomedical research. But her own family members couldn't afford some of the benefits that came from the use of their mother's cells.
Narrow profit margins for Canadian uranium companies operating in Niger. Big health risks for Nigerian miners.
The risk doesn't go away. There's no possibility to protect miners 100% from radioactivity with the not-so-strict regulations and the not-so-strict enforcement of regulations. There will be health impacts and risks for the people who work there and who live in the area.
Before digging down, help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Henrietta Lacks, not a household name. Lacks was a black woman, child of Virginia sharecroppers. She ended up in Baltimore. There, around the age of 30, she came down with cervical cancer in the course of surgery in the colored ward at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Unbeknownst to her, a piece of her cervix was removed, then passed along to a medical researcher. Henrietta Lacks died of her cancer. Her cells turned out to be immortal, doing what no line of cultured human cells had ever done, reproduce indefinitely in lab dishes. HeLa cells, as they came to be known, revolutionized biomedical research. Among the advances they leveraged, the polio vaccine, treatment for sickle cell anemia, and in vitro fertilization. HeLa cells also generated huge profit for a company called Thermo Fisher Scientific. The Lacks family never saw a penny. Indeed, advanced medical treatments made possible by HeLa cells were beyond their means. In 2021, the Lacks family launched a lawsuit against Thermo Fisher. This past August, the case was settled for an undisclosed sum. I spoke about Henrietta Lacks and medical racism in America with Dorothy Roberts. Roberts is a professor of law and sociology and a scholar on race, gender, and law at the University of Pennsylvania. That's where I reached her. Who was Henrietta Lacks?
Henrietta Lacks was a woman who was raised on a sharecropping farm in Virginia and moved to outside of Baltimore. She had cervical cancer and was treated in a colored ward at Johns Hopkins Hospital in the 1950s. She was a mother with several children, a wife. And when she discovered that she had a tumor, she was treated at the only place she could be at that time at Johns Hopkins, which was the closest hospital, in a segregated part of the hospital for Black patients. And while she was there, a piece of her cervix was taken by one of the physicians and given to another physician researcher at the hospital. And they discovered that her cells, her cancer cells, were really miraculous. They multiplied and stayed alive in the lab, unlike any other cells before, and so were extremely useful for biomedical research and, in fact, were used for multiple kinds of experiments. In fact, it's said that everybody in the United States and many, many people around the globe have benefited from biomedical research done with her cells.
I mean, these were, you know, her cells were used to develop the polio vaccine, the human papillomavirus vaccine, the COVID vaccine. They were taken into space.
Yes, they were useful for developing in vitro fertilization processes, multiple kinds of pharmaceuticals. And it's just impossible really to quantify how much benefit came from her cells. But it's important to note that she never gave consent for them to be taken. She didn't even know they were taken. And in fact, her family didn't know until many years later and were never compensated until very recently for the use of her cells. And in fact, her family was impoverished and didn't benefit from the medical developments and drugs. I think one of the greatest contradictions in Henrietta Lacks's story is that her own family members couldn't afford some of the benefits that came from the use of their mother's cells.
Which were referred to and are referred to as immortal.
Yes, they're immortal because they don't die. They continue to multiply. And this was the, as I said, the first time that scientists have been able to use cells that didn't die very quickly in a lab. And so they were extremely plentiful and useful for biomedical research.
How much did Thermo Fisher make? What was the estimated profits that they earned from the use of HeLa cells, as they're called? They're called HeLa cells.
Yes, I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but it was billions of dollars. And I know that I read that the CEO of the company earned $26 billion in 1 year. So this was very, very, very lucrative for the company to have used these cells. The CEO in the lawsuit that her family brought to get compensation from Thermo Fisher, it noted that the compensation package for the CEO was over $26 million.
Dorothy Roberts, you mentioned that in the beginning that Henrietta Lacks was treated for her cervical cancer in the colored ward of Johns Hopkins Medical Center. There was a white ward, of course, this was in the 1950s. There was a white ward and a colored ward. What was the difference in treatment between patients in the white ward and the colored ward?
The difference was that the best treatment, the most advanced technologies and therapies, the greatest care was given to white patients. And patients in the colored ward received inferior care and were treated as if they were inferior human beings. That was the whole point of having segregated medicine. And I think this is important to note because there's some people who say, well, any impoverished patient was treated poorly by medicine at the time. And in fact, the idea was that they could be experimented on and their bodies used for research in compensation for the free medical care they were getting because they couldn't afford the cost of medical care. Of course, that is an unethical argument, but I've heard that argument made to excuse the racism that also shaped what happened to Henrietta Lacks and most Black patients in hospitals at the time. And so I think it's important to place what happened to Henrietta Lacks and the colored ward in the context of the history of segregated medicine in America. And of course, in Europe as well. But I think it reached its most horrific levels in the United States, because segregated medicine is inextricably linked to the history of slavery in the United States and the ideologies that surrounded that, including the very basic idea that human beings are naturally divided into races and white people are superior in every way to Black people to justify enslaving them, and then having an entire system of medicine that was completely linked to enslaving Black people and justifying their enslavement as beneficial to their health. So then after slavery ended, we have in the United States the segregation of medicine until the civil rights movement, until the 1960s. So you have, even after slavery ended, more than a century of segregated medicine, where medicine for Black people was inferior and infused with this idea that Black people's bodies operated differently than white people's bodies, and that Black people should be subjected, because they were deemed inferior, to medical experimentation. And so all of this way of thinking about medicine and practicing medicine, race-based medicine, segregated medicine, was the background for what happened to Henrietta Lacks in the colored ward. So as the United States Supreme Court recognized in Brown versus Board of Education, care, you know, in that case, education, but healthcare as well, is innately unequal. That's, it was set up to treat Black people in an inferior way. And we see the reverberations of that in medicine to this very day.
And I heard your conversation with Amy Goodman, in which you said that scientists would go into, and maybe still do, go into Black communities and prisons where a disproportionately high number of prisoners are Black people of color. Scientists go into those communities and situations expressly to do research. Can you talk more about this?
Oh, absolutely. So again, this is an afterlife of the idea during the slavery era that Black people were incapable of giving consent or not giving consent, and should be subjected to biomedical experimentation for the benefit of white people. And let me just say, this is another contradiction in that it's based on the idea that Black people have inferior bodies that should be subjected to control, and yet the experimentation on our bodies are used to benefit all other human beings. So there's that innate contradiction in it. But flowing from that basic ideology is the continuation of biomedical research throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century in Black communities. Probably the most notorious example of that is the government-funded experiment in Tuskegee, Alabama. Federal government funded a study that took hundreds of Black sharecroppers, impoverished Black people, and who had syphilis, and looked at the impact of syphilis on their bodies without treating them with known treatments. So they were denied treatments, unbeknownst to them, tricked into this study for the purpose of seeing how syphilis affected Black people's bodies. So, you know, again, just completely entangled with these ideologies, white supremacist ideologies of inferiority and difference of Black people's bodies. But that's just one example. That's probably the best known, but it is common even to this day to use Black communities as sites for biomedical experimentation, and especially vulnerable Black research subjects, really, in this case, incarcerated people. Another lesser known, but should be equally notorious, a set of experiments actually out of my university, University of Pennsylvania, by a dermatologist who studied the impact of various drugs, cosmetics. In fact, he developed Retin A on the skin of incarcerated Black men in a prison in Philadelphia. And also children in foster care have been subjected to medical experimentation. And in the United States also, children in foster care, especially in big cities like Baltimore, Chicago, New York, are disproportionately Black.
Now, I mean, this would be perhaps a naive comment or a naive question, but how is this possible in this day and age? This sort of experimentation, I would imagine, violates the Nuremberg Code.
Well, today the experimentation would be done with consent, but when you take people who are vulnerable in prisons, children in foster care, there's a question as to what constitutes voluntary consent when you have people who are in coercive situations. So I don't want to suggest that there has been no change in the form of experimentation from the time of slavery until today. Of course, it has changed, but we can see a through line, a pattern of exploitation that began during an era where Black people were deemed not to be able to consent or not consent during the slavery era, then during the period before the civil rights movement, where people were experimented on, coercively sterilized en masse, into the 1970s, actually even past the passage of civil rights laws, through various coercive means. For example, much of my work is in reproductive justice, and I've studied the mass sterilization of Black women. And it happens in multiple ways, in sterilizing women in prison. So what does it mean to get consent from someone who is incarcerated? And this has been going on very recently. There was an expose of sterilization of Black and Latina women in the California prison system about a decade ago.
And First Nations people experienced the same sort of situation. In Canada, for example, in Canada, as late as the late 1970s, it was only just recently, in the last couple of years, revealed that in a First Nations community in Northern Manitoba, health authorities actually experimented on children. They divided Aboriginal children into two groups. And one group, they provided great breakfasts with milk, and the rest of it, the other group, they didn't. And they wanted to see what impact this differential treatment would have on their dental health.
Yeah, exactly. So,
which astonished me when I read about this and a lot of other people, because I mean, this violates the Nuremberg Code.
I think so too. So I'll give you another example. In the late 1980s, the Medical University of South Carolina began a program of testing pregnant patients who were almost exclusively Black patients for the use of drugs, and then turning them over to Child Protective Services and the police. And dozens of women were arrested while pregnant or shortly after giving birth as part of this collaboration between the hospital, police, and prosecutors. Now, this was a form of experimentation, because the theory behind it was that this coercive, punitive practice, completely unethical, right? But this practice would deter their patients from using drugs while pregnant. It went on for several years with multiple arrests of all Black women except for one white woman whose baby was Black. And finally, the U.S. Government stopped it as an unethical experiment on human subjects, because that's what it was. But only after dozens of women were arrested and their babies taken from them. So there's so many different forms of this. And I agree with you, violate international norms of ethics. And they also violate ethical norms in another way, which is reflected in Henrietta Lacks's story of not giving back to the communities the benefits that are achieved through the research that's done on them. So this is extremely common, and again, happens typically in marginalized communities, Black communities, Indigenous communities, immigrant communities, Latinx in Puerto Rico, Mexican origin communities. This happens where, yes, there may be consent forms signed, often because of the need for income in these communities, because they may be, unlike with the Henrietta Lacks's case, they may be offered a small amount of money to participate in the study. And then the study yields results that may offer billions of dollars to pharmaceutical and biotech companies, and the communities get nothing back except the puny amount of a stipend that they may have gotten, if that. And so I think this is also something that the Henrietta Lacks lawsuit brings out, which is there should be compensation, adequate compensation, ethical compensation for the people who participate in these studies. And so I think there is a range of unethical practices that, you know, at the perhaps the greatest atrocity, of course, is experimentation without consent, especially when it's harmful to the subject, the research subject. But there's also coercive practices that are unethical, denying benefits if you don't participate, offering someone who's impoverished a small amount of money to participate in a study that's not going to benefit them otherwise, or going into communities that are vulnerable and conducting research without their true participation, and then without true benefits to the community. And this is why I think Henrietta Lacks's family's lawsuit that settled for some amount of compensation, I think we don't know exactly what that was. And I should add also a previous agreement with the National Institutes of Health that the family would be consulted before Henrietta Lacks's cells were distributed to researchers. And so, you know, Henrietta Lacks's family has never said stop the research. They've always demanded that they have greater input and get adequate and fair and ethical compensation. And so the message coming out of this lawsuit, I think, is greater than just the benefit to the family. I think it's a call for more ethical research that provides true compensation and benefits to the communities that are being used for research.
What are the prospects for the biomedical institutions to change as the result of the Henrietta Lacks litigation, like the National Institute of Health and the major biomedical centers in the United States?
I think that Henrietta Lacks's family's lawsuit is one piece of a broader movement to make biomedical and other scientific research more trustworthy, more ethical. You know, on the one hand, there is this question, how can we get a marginalized populations to trust scientific research more? The question should be, how can we make scientific research more trustworthy? Yes, we know that there is an aversion by many people of color to participate in biomedical and other scientific research because of this long history, which people are aware of.
So are any practical measures being discussed or instituted? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, in the United States, the National Institute of Health.
Yes, I recently served last year and into this spring on a committee of the National Institutes, National Academy, I should say, of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, funded by the National Institutes of Health, on the use of population descriptors, including race, ethnicity, and ancestry in genetic and genomic research. And our committee, which was made up of mostly genomic scientists, but also other biomedical researchers and a few social scientists like me, we addressed the long history of genomic science, incorporating these false and dangerous ideas about race, and conducting research that was unethical on marginalized communities. And we wrote a report, which was published in March, that number one, calls for an end to the use of race as a proxy for human genomic variation, but also devotes a big part of the report to calling on genomic researchers to engage in trustworthy scientific research, which includes, importantly, participation by the communities that are being researched, studied in the design and the benefits of the research. I highly recommend this report, which is available online. It also calls on multiple participants in the research, not only the researchers themselves, but also biomedical and other scientific journals, on foundations, on government entities, including the National Institutes of Health, to promote this change in the historical way in which scientific research is conducted. And the National Academies is now putting together a committee, sort of an after a follow-up on our report on biomedical research. And so I think, given our committee's report and the work that this committee will do coming out of the National Institutes of Health, it will, and the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, it can have an impact. Now, that's coming from, you know, sort of the elite of science, calling on scientists and those who fund scientists and publish scientists' work to make this change. I think that as important, if not more so, are the demands of people of color, like the Lacks family, and in organizations to which I would call a growing movement to demand change. So I think, you know, from both ends, of course, any kind of major change like this, you have to understand that these ideas are rooted in an institution that lasted for 400 years, you know, the institution of enslaving African people, and then another 150 years of medicine and scientific research deeply shaped by these same ideologies. And so we're talking about, you know, many centuries of research that is grounded in false and dangerous ideas about race, and that continues to be taught in medical schools and biology lectures, and genomics research continues to be published to this day. And so that's why I have a lot of hope today, because I see